Okay. So let me just do the register first. Keep Dace happy that I'm keeping track of who's here. Right, so Robert Barclay Roberts here. Okay, and Isabel Collins. No. Daniel Connor. Yep. Mm-hmm. And Alison Craig. Not seen Alison for a few weeks. David Derbyshire. Yeah, that's right. And Brendan Herron. Brendan's here, yep. Jenny Mackay. Yeah, that's right. Hello. Barbara Shaw. Not seen her either. Mark Silver. That's Mark, isn't it? Yep. Uh-huh. And Hugh Tate. Yes. Tony White. Tony's here. Jane White. Yeah, that's right. I'm starting to put faces to names. William McQueen is, yep, that's right. Peter Agnew. Yep. And Avril Taylor. No. Okay, Robert Aitken.
Yeah.
Is that good? And Margaret McVean. Margaret's here. Did I miss anyone out? Okay, that's good. Right. Let's just see what we can do with these lights at the front. Is that okay for everyone?
Yeah.
Not too dark. Okay. Right. Let's see where we've got to. So we're actually at halfway mark already, and what I'm proposing to do tonight is to continue with the story of stars and what the Hubble telescope has helped to tell us about how stars are born and live and die. I'll fall a wee bit short of talking about supernovae in particular. I'll say a bit about them, but I'll reserve a longer discussion about Hubble telescope observations of supernovae until a subsequent week, because when we get into looking at what Hubble has helped us to learn about cosmology, then the supernovae will play a very special role there. So before we move on to even bigger scales in the second half of the course and discuss galaxies and cosmology in the Hubble telescope, we'll first of all backtrack a bit, because I want to talk about extrasolar planets and what the Hubble telescope has helped us to learn about those. So that will follow on from a discussion of the stars, and I don't know how far we'll get into it tonight. We might not even get into any of it tonight, but certainly by the end of next week we should have covered stars and planets, and then that will leave four sessions to look at the wider universe and hopefully also wrap up with some discussion of where things will lie with future space telescopes. So just like last week, I'll do my best to keep my voice going. I haven't quite shaken off this nasty cough, so hopefully I'm not too contagious, and I'm quite far away from you anyway, so that's maybe a good thing. We'll see how that... there you go, you see. Talk about the cough and suddenly I start. Excuse me. I'll try and filter them out of the MP3 files before I put them on the web. Can I begin then by asking if there's any questions from what we've talked about in the last few weeks? Anything? Robert? Yeah. Mhm.
It's only when I'm thinking about it later, at the very beginning of the sequence, you start off with two protons. And the way the diagram looks, it looks like they merge, and then at some point one of the protons turns into a neutron.
Mhm. A neutrino. Yeah, sure.
And
that's right.
I was wondering, do they stick together as two protons for some time, and then one of the protons changes?
Almost immediately it happens. I mean, you know, at least compared with the time scales for the initial reaction to happen, the decay that produces the positron and the neutrino coming off is, I don't know what the figure is. I could probably get the figure during the break. I kind of know where to look, you know, to get what the timescales would be, but my instinct tells me it would be an awful lot shorter than the billion years that it takes the initial reaction, of more like a fraction of a second, in fact. But I can't recall the exact number. But yeah, so it's virtually instantaneous compared with the timescale for the long reaction.
Does that mean one of the protons is more likely to come into an electron just because it's got itself stuck onto another?
That is an excellent question. I think so. I think it's fundamentally one of the reasons why you get the decay of one of the protons is because the deuterium, the helium-2, important distinction, that has, you know, initially been formed when you've got the two protons isn't very stable. So, you know, what that will seek to do is to decay into something more stable, which turns out to be a proton and a neutron. So actually what you've got instead is deuterium, just a heavier form of hydrogen. It's all to do with the instability of the helium-2, whereas the final product that you got at the end, I'm not sure if I've got the chain on here. Yes, I have actually. On the right-hand side, helium-4 is much more stable. So there's no problem with that lasting for a longer time. But yes, so that's a good question. Yeah.
Do stars throw off deuterons?
Yes, I imagine it. Well, there'll be a proportion of the hydrogen nuclei that we get from the sun which will be in the form of heavy hydrogen. Again, I'm not sure what the proportion would be, but the way that you would tell that that's the case, well, there's a variety of ways, because in the case of the solar wind, you can actually capture it, you know. But you would also see evidence of it in terms of spectral lines, because if it's, say, it was a wind from another star, then the presence of the wind can be revealed by what that wind does when it interacts with other material between us and the star, and the spectral lines that you would get from hydrogen containing just a proton will be slightly different from what one might get if you had deuterium. So the presence of deuterium in the universe as a whole can be deduced from a variety of... Well, you know, by and large, spectral lines are much more to do with what the electrons are doing.
Right.
But there are, you know, some features that one can look for, essentially what's referred to usually as fine structure, which is, you know, you need a very good spectrometer. Actually, you know, Hubble's probably a good example of where you would have a good enough spectrometer. I can probably find you some spectra where there's just very small splits in the spectral lines, and it can be to do with the subtle differences. But even if the wavelength is identical, what will be different depending on which isotope it is will be the strength of the line, because you know, the relative abundances of deuterium versus ordinary hydrogen can be revealed by looking at the line strength. Now that, maybe we will cover this in a few weeks, it's not something that Hubble has contributed directly to, but our knowledge about the very early universe is based on an understanding that many of, well, not many, almost all, in fact, of the lightest elements were manufactured not in stars, but in the very early universe. And therefore, it is quite instructive to try to measure the relative abundances of deuterium and regular hydrogen, and indeed tritium is the other form of hydrogen that's got two neutrons and one proton, and because it tells you something about the sorts of nuclear reactions that were going on in the very early universe. Well, that's a field known as nucleosynthesis, and is a very powerful piece of evidence in favour of the Big Bang, because the predicted abundances of these isotopes matches very well what we observe if the universe was very hot a long time ago, very dense, very much more compact than it is now, and that's, of course, what the Big Bang says the universe was like a very long time ago. Okay, so I'll come back to that. That's an excellent question. And I'll make a wee note of that, actually. I'll see if I can find you some spectra with isotopes of hydrogen.
You don't call the stuff proterium.
No, at least I've not heard that phrase. Where a number of the names of the elements come from is, of course, quite interesting. You know, there's strontium, which is named, I believe, after the little village Strontian in the Highlands. Helium is named after the sun, because it's very hard to find helium in the Earth. You know, we can manufacture it, but the spectral lines were first identified looking at the sun spectrum. You know, the realisation that this was clearly an element that didn't fit the pattern of any that we found regularly here on Earth. Okie doke. Anything else then to get our thoughts going? Right, well, I'm sure there'll be lots more, so don't hesitate to ask away as we go along. I'll do my best to answer on the spot, or as I've been doing, you know, jot down things to mention in a subsequent week. So Robert asked about the PP chain, that led to some further discussion of that. You know, obviously a lot of what we've discussed in that regard is quite far removed from the observations that Hubble makes, but it's the theory that underpins all of those observations. And I just want to very briefly recap a little bit of that. We talked about what's called the colour magnitudes, or Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which is a way that astronomers plot the positions of stars of different brightnesses or luminosity. The other method that we use to measure that is called the absolute magnitude. And then we can also classify them by their colour or their spectral type, which in turn is related to their surface temperature. So the main message from last week's discussion of this aspect of the theory was that stars during their regular lifetime, when they're turning hydrogen into helium, in the case of a star like the Sun, can do that for billions of years using this proton-proton chain that we discussed, such stars spend their time on what's called the main sequence, which is identified by this red curve here. And on the main sequence, you can have cool stars, like the red dwarfs represented by Barnard's star here, which is very near to us, one of the closest stars to the Earth. You can have the Sun, of course. You can have somewhat hotter stars like Sirius, well, Sirius A technically, because the Sirius star system consists of several stars. And then you can have very much hotter stars, some of which begin to branch off into what we call the supergiants branch. But you can have cool supergiants as well, and cool supergiants represented by Betelgeuse and Orion that we've seen in a few previous slides, and also Antares, which is a star in the constellation of Taurus, the Bull. Those are very, very big stars, and those are stars which are reaching the end of their life after... Go ahead.
The outer edge is cool.
The outer edge is cool, yes. The inner part of the star will still be hot. Good point. We'll see a bit more about that shortly, because we'll look at what is going on inside such a star, but the outer part is cool. So this number here, I mean, as you can see, it says surface temperature. These numbers just relate to the outer part of the star. Yep, good point. Okay, so that was the big picture. We looked at some of the details, aspects of which were, I suppose, a little bit esoteric to do with all these subatomic particles banging into each other. But the essence of it is that all stars turn hydrogen into helium, but they do it at different rates depending on their temperature, depending on their luminosity, which ultimately depends on their mass. It depends on how massive they are, how big they are. So blue stars are hotter, they're more luminous, but they're also more massive. And that means that they use up their hydrogen faster. So they've got more hydrogen to begin with, but they burn it more quickly. And therefore, they don't actually stay in the main sequence for all that long. So a star, which is a blue giant star, and I think we had a sort of artist's impression of that. That's right, that was the next one. Showed you this slide before, a former colleague of mine who's got a bit more into the sort of astro art business. Did this for a book he was working on a few years ago, and it just nicely shows the range of scales. You've got the Earth, you've got Jupiter, you've got the Sun, and then you've got a blue supergiant star. So a blue star like this might only be a few tens of millions of years old, because it can't be any older than that, because it wouldn't last long enough. It would have used up its hydrogen too fast to allow it to maintain its lifetime for longer. So what happens to such a star when it reaches the end of that lifetime? Well, before we look at the more dramatic cases, let's just briefly touch on what would be going on. You know, I mentioned the fact that the blue stars use up their hydrogen more quickly. So how exactly does that work? Well, the way it works is that they burn the hydrogen via a different sequence of reactions. Instead of the proton-proton chain, and remember the crucial point to that is that the first step in that proton-proton chain took a long time to happen, took of order a billion years before the two protons bang together. So if you could find a faster way to make the fusion reactions happen, then you could use up the hydrogen faster. Well, one such example is called the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen, or CNO cycle. The trouble is, it will only happen if the star's much hotter. So a star like the Sun isn't massive enough and hot enough for the CNO cycle to kick in, because you've got to have much higher pressure, which leads to higher temperature at the centre of such a star. But if the star's more massive than the Sun, few times the mass of the Sun and upwards, then the central conditions at the core of such a star are hot enough to allow this faster reaction to take over.
Does it start as a CNO or does it start
as a CNO? No, it would start as a CNO because, your question's a good one, but it sort of relates to what even many textbooks, I think, slightly misrepresent about stellar evolution. And as recently as a couple of weeks ago when I was in India, it was excellent to see that they were having a number of astronomy events at the science festival I was at, and I wasn't going to make a big fuss about this, but the local student astronomy society at the university, they did a talk and they got this bit all wrong, because what they talked about stars doing was joining the main sequence and moving along the main sequence during their lifetime. That doesn't happen. What happens is that a star will be formed with a certain mass, and that's ultimately determined just by how much gas there is around. And out of that newly forming star, if it's massive enough, then the CNO cycle will basically kick in right away. And if it isn't massive enough, then it's destined to spend its entire main sequence lifetime just using the PP chain. It isn't a case of it can go from one to the other. The only slight caveat I should add to that is that in a binary star system, it's maybe just possible that what could happen is it could grab some material from a binary companion, and then that could push it over the mass limit. But, that would be quite difficult to arrange to happen. So by and large, stars just begin at some point along this red curve, and they just stay there. They don't move. Until they leave the main sequence, in which case they'll then become a red giant or supergiant, and eventually a white dwarf. But we'll come to that. So the CNO cycle, I want to keep this fairly simple and not get too bogged down in all the symbols and equations and things. But the main thing to stress is, it's a cycle. You can see that the arrows kind of go round in a big circle. And secondly, it involves chemical elements that are very important for life here on Earth. So it's quite ironic that our own star doesn't undergo this CNO cycle, but it tells you that carbon, nitrogen and oxygen, as well as playing an important role in us being here, do also play quite an important role in stellar evolution and stars' lives. So actually, again, I misoverestimated the number, as somebody might have said. I'd forgotten that. The mass only has to be about 10% bigger than the mass of the Sun. Forgive me for remembering that wrongly. But the temperature's got to be quite a bit more. Instead of something like 10 million degrees, you're looking at more like 16 million degrees for it to be hot enough for a star to undergo the CNO cycle. And I see there's all sorts of arcane details of that we needn't go into here. But the 9.97 m, that's the half-life. It's how long it would take for half of the nitrogen you begin with to undergo the reaction turning into carbon. And that's only 10 million years. So that's the crucial thing to take from this, is that it's hundreds of times faster than the PP chain reactions. So you're going to use up your hydrogen mighty fast with the CNO cycle. There's an even more elaborate one, the hot CNO cycle, that again, let's not get bogged down in the details, but you can see that it involves even more chemical elements that we've all heard of. There's neon, there's fluorine, there's sodium. But basically what's going on through all of this is that you're turning hydrogen into helium. The other elements are just acting as a catalyst. I think I used that word last week. They're just there to help the reaction along, but they don't actually get used up. Okay? So it's still basically hydrogen being turned into helium.
I take it there are no stars that have absolutely no metal in them.
Well, that's a very good question. Again, there must probably have been in the very, very early universe, because as we'll see in a moment, really anything that isn't hydrogen or helium to an astronomer is called a metal.
That's what I mean by metal.
Yeah, I was just checking that that was what you meant. I thought it probably was. But for others who wouldn't be familiar with that, to simplify the periodic table, you've all seen the periodic table in chemistry classes and things. In fact, it's a bit surprising there isn't one in the wall here. There often is in all of our science lecture rooms. But the periodic table for astronomers is extremely simple. It's H, HE, and everything else, just all lumped into one. Now there's a very good reason for that, which is that actually the amount of all those other elements put together is really minuscule. So for all the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen and some of these other elements are important for stellar processes these days, We don't believe that there's all that much of it around. And when we ask ourselves, where did it all come from? As we'll see shortly, it came from stars. So does that mean that there was once a time when you had stars that didn't have these chemical elements that we refer to as metals, the heavy stuff, to help the reactions along? So that sort of links back to Tony's question. It's very likely that the first generations of stars really must have been just proton-proton chain, because there wouldn't have been the metals around to help things along. It's extremely hard to get a handle on all of that, though, because you're looking at stars which must be, by necessity, very far away, so you're seeing them a long time ago, and that means that they're hard to see. So Hubble probably isn't, you know, in the remaining few years of its life, or however long it goes for, going to shed very much light on that. But the next generation space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, as we'll see in probably the very final week, may well help us to understand how the first stars formed, because it will be able to see much further, deeper, and further into the past. And it might just be able to reveal what those first stars were like. More generally, what we can certainly see is, if you measure what astronomers call the metallicity, that's, you know, the relative amount of these heavier chemical elements, if you measure the metallicity of galaxies, and you can do that by looking at their spectra and looking for the relative abundance of heavier elements like, you know, iron, sodium, all these things, then you do generally see that very, very far away galaxies, which are younger, have lower metallicity. And that's likely because they just simply don't have so many stars in them with these heavier elements that have been manufactured. Okay? The questions are excellent. It's just a matter of kind of trying to answer them in the right sequence, because I'm mindful that that partly anticipates things coming up. So let's get on to that. But before we get into a bit more of the theory, and I say there's not that much of it to go anyway, let's just take a bit of a deep breath and look at some more nice pictures, which is still very instructive in its own way. So these are two star clusters in the Small Magellanic Cloud, and this is an image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope in the early years of this decade. So it was after the advanced camera system had already been installed. And the Small Magellanic Cloud is a little companion galaxy close to the Milky Way, but close is a relative term, of course. It's 150,000 light years or so from the Earth, from the Milky Way. Only visible in the southern hemisphere. I've been lucky enough to see them a few times. But of course, if you look at it through a big telescope like Hubble, then you see details which are completely lost to the naked eye. And in these clusters, you can see groups of hot blue stars. So these are quite young clusters. I think I might have showed these at the end of last week as well. We know they're quite young because they've still got these hot blue stars in them. And of course that means that they can't be all that old, because the blue stars would have used up their fuel by then. They would have passed through their early stages of life. And this little knot of stars in here is particularly young. These are perhaps just a few million years old. And the likelihood is that this example of two star clusters forming quite recently might be an indication that something has kind of disrupted the Small Magellanic Cloud in the quite recent past. We'll see lots of examples of that in the next few weeks, because we're going to look at what Hubble's shown us about galaxy formation. And when galaxies form, generally it's through quite a similar process to how stars form. Gas clouds collapsing. But also what you can have is galaxies merging with each other, and they can twist and pull each other, essentially just gravity distorting their shapes, and that can trigger star formation. And that's possibly what we think might have kick-started some star formation in the Magellanic Clouds in the fairly recent past, and see Hubble's revealing things like that all the time. Here's another example. Let me just get my names right again, so it's a bit hard to remember the names of all these things. I've posted the notes with all the names of these pretty pictures on the website as well, just to keep you right. Yeah, this one is NGC 1850. And again, okay, that name doesn't mean much anyway, it's just a catalogue number. But this is in the Large Magellanic Cloud, so another satellite galaxy of our own. So another rich cluster of pretty young stars, But what this stuff over here is believed to be the remnant of a supernova explosion. So I think maybe in the very first week, or possibly I repeated it last week, I mentioned that what we think can often trigger star formation is either, as I mentioned a few seconds ago, the merger of two galaxies or two clusters, and the tidal force of gravity pulling the gas around and maybe compressing it. Well, that can also happen if a supernova explosion happens. It sends out a kind of shock wave through the surrounding space, which can compress gas. In fact, you know, to be honest, a fairly good, if not entirely scientifically accurate, representation of that is some of the special effects work when the Death Star blows up at the end of Star Wars. You can see this kind of blast wave spreading out. A supernova explosion would by and large be pretty much like that, although probably it would be spherical. The blast wave would go out more or less evenly in all directions. So when that blast wave has passed through the star cluster here, then it may well have triggered some even more recent star formation, including the little knot of stars down here. So a key indicator of how old a star is how hot it is, because that puts a kind of limit on how old it can be. Because if it's really, really hot, then it simply can't be old, because it wouldn't have been able to survive for that long. But there are other ways we can tell about the ages of clusters, and we'll get on to that in the next few slides. Because by contrast, for example, here's a very old cluster. This is called a globular cluster, 47 Tucanae. It's a very famous one. In fact, I think I showed you this last week. I showed a movie where we zoomed in on a little portion of stars observed by Hubble. Well, these were those stars. The globular cluster 47 Tucanae is a few tens of thousands of light years from the Earth. It's a globular cluster orbiting the Milky Way, and it contains about a million stars. And, well, most of them are red. Now, that doesn't prove it's an old one, because after all, you could have a new cluster that forms some red stars as well. But it's consistent with it being a very old star cluster, because all the blue ones have gone long, long ago. But what you've got left behind is the less massive, cooler red stars that can last a long time because they don't use up their hydrogen so fast. Now, there are other more sophisticated ways that we can tell more precisely how old a cluster like that is, and we're just coming to that in a few minutes. But it's a beautiful image, and it shows detail that you simply couldn't get from even a big ground-based telescope, and it's because you're above the atmosphere. Here's another one. NGC 6093. Similarly, you see that there's lots of red, orangey-red, cooler, older stars there. And here's another. Let me see if I've got this one noted down. Possibly don't, actually. I'm afraid I don't recognise it. No, I need to check that one during the break. I think it might be NGC 290, but I'm not sure. But that one is actually not a globular cluster. It's another example of an open cluster. So the contrast we've had in these last few slides is that sometimes you have a star cluster where stars have been formed very recently, and sometimes you have a star cluster where they're all quite tightly packed together, and most of them probably formed a very, very long time ago, billions of years ago. So how can we tell the difference? Well, we do it by making diagrams like this one. This is basically the same type of colour magnitude diagram that I showed you before. So if we go just zoom back quickly, there's my sort of cartoon version of it, which is very painstakingly made using PowerPoint. And there is one for a real star cluster. So this big band here is the main sequence. Okay, just like that red curve that was shown on my cartoon drawing. So this is data that was obtained with the Hubble Space Telescope. These strange looking numbers up here, Fe over H, that's a way of measuring the metal content. So as Bernard was asking about, Brendan, sorry, was asking about the metallicity or the metal content. The more negative this number is, then the lower the amount of metals It's just a way of measuring it. It's just done using logarithms. So that's something you can measure from the spectra. The other important thing is that notice there's this kind of hook shape. These are where stars are turning off the main sequence, where they've just reached a point where they've used up as much hydrogen as they can to sustain the PP chain reactions, or if they're hot enough, the CNO cycle. But what they've got to do then is they've got to contract in the core, and at the same time they expand in the outer part. And what the contraction of the core achieves for them is gets the core even hotter still, so that actually helium can start fusing into heavier elements. But meanwhile, the outer part of the star has expanded and cooled. You've got yourself a red giant. So the point is, as you move down the main sequence, maybe it's worthwhile just going back to our little cartoon drawing again. Remember I said that the further down this red curve you are, the cooler the star is, but also the less massive the star is. So remember, the really massive ones use up their hydrogen first. The less massive use up their hydrogen more slowly. So this is effectively a way to tell how old the cluster is. It's a bit like tree rings or something like that. You know, that how far down the main sequence you are is a measure of how long the stars in that cluster have been burning their hydrogen for. If the turn off in the main sequence is near the top, then that means it's only the very biggest stars that you've lost already. Therefore, the cluster must be quite young. If the turn off is further down, then it means that you're already losing less massive stars, which means they must have been burning their hydrogen for a longer time, therefore the cluster's older. It's not very exact, but it's pretty good, and you can tell the difference between a cluster that's 10 billion years old, or 5 billion, or 1 billion, or even just a few hundred million. It's quite precise. So, it's not perfect, but I say it's not bad. And here's one example. So basically, this turn-off point here is an indication, you know, by working out, so that these funny numbers here refer to the filters that are used in the Hubble telescope, by working out how bright the stars are which are just turning off the main sequence, and hence determining what their temperature and mass is, you can work out how old a cluster would need to be in order for stars of that mass to be leaving the main sequence. Okay, it's quite a subtle argument, but it's an incredibly useful thing because it means you can use these clusters as clocks. Now, we'd been doing it for a long time before Hubble came along, but what Hubble provided us with was much more precise measurements of the colour magnitude diagrams that allowed us to do this ageing process more accurately. And it's been very helpful. An excellent question. You really can, actually. That's one of the things that what we would like to do as well is to try and simultaneously estimate the age of the cluster, but also somehow estimate what the initial spread of masses was.
Just wonder if that made it difficult.
It does indeed. It makes it extremely difficult. I've not worked in that myself, but one of my colleagues that I've worked with for a very long time, in fact, the person organising the Paris meeting that I didn't get to a few weeks ago, he has pioneered a method of doing exactly that, of trying to sort of simultaneously get an age estimate for the cluster and also to try to constrain what the distribution of masses must have been to begin with. And like so often in astronomy, it's a bit of guesswork really, but what you can do is you can at least to try and do it in the following way. You can say, well, this is what I think the age of the cluster is if the initial mass distribution was like this, but if the initial mass distribution was different, and you specify that somehow, then you work out a different age, and therefore it gives you what you would term a more robust estimate, because it's subject to fewer assumptions. You know, you're saying, well, okay, we don't really know what the initial mass distribution was like, but it doesn't really seem to make that much difference to my answer when I work out the age. Those are the kind of cross-checks that you would want to make. And it's all very important because, as I said last week, the one thing above all that you're limited by here is you can't actually wait and see the cluster evolve. You've just got a snapshot. So you're trying to deduce the past history from just the snapshot. It's like, you know, looking at a photograph of someone when they're, you know, my age, in trying to deduce what their childhood was like. You know, it's not always very easy, but maybe there are some clues, and you know, that's the sort of study that we have to try to do. And fortunately, of course, in many ways, studying things like stars is a lot simpler than studying people in photographs. I'm reminded of a story many of you might have heard, although I've heard it in various versions, so it's not completely clear who said what to whom, but apparently Fred Hoyle, famous astronomer from Britain, who was the person responsible for the phrase the Big Bang, sort of coining that phrase, was once reported to have said in a lecture that stars are actually pretty simple things. And I suppose what he was getting at was the point that all you really need to model a star is to know its mass and its temperature, and you're a good way towards understanding what it's going to do. And some wag from the back of the audience had said, well, you'd look pretty simple from 10 light years away too, Fred. And, you know, it's a fair point, because a lot of my colleagues that work on the Sun tell me, oh, you know, the Sun's a really complicated star. And I tease them and say, well, that's just because you know too much about the Sun. If you look at these very faraway things, it's easier to model them. And I'm sure, therefore, there's a degree of simplicity, maybe oversimplicity, in the models that we use to try to age these clusters. But it probably, the answer's along the right lines. And that can be quite important, because about 10 years ago, we discovered, as we'll learn much more about in the second half of the course, that the universe is not only expanding, but we think it's speeding up. Now, that was a startling discovery that we'll look at in much more detail in the weeks to come, and we'll discuss Hubble's role in that discovery. But in a way, it wasn't, you know, as many things that are in life, with the benefit of a little hindsight, it wasn't entirely surprising. And one of the reasons is that although this speeding up universe, this accelerating universe, has many weird properties, one fortunate consequence of this discovery was that it made us think that the universe was actually a bit older than we had thought before. Now, that was good news, because around the same time, the Hubble telescope was allowing us to age some of these star clusters by the method I described. And rather embarrassingly, at that time, it was looking as if the stars in these star clusters were older than we thought the universe was. So something was clearly wrong, and there were two ways to fix this problem. One was to discover that we'd got the ages of the star clusters too high, or to discover that we'd got the age of the universe too low. And it looked very much as if it was the latter. See, again, we'll get more into that. But, you know, the one thing that astronomers will always strive to do is to find different ways of answering a similar question. So you can try to work out how old the universe is by looking at properties of the universe itself, or you can try to work out how old the universe is by looking at old things in the universe and saying, well, it's at least got to be as old as them. And fortunately now we're in a position where those two answers are at least consistent. But in the late 1990s they weren't, and we just didn't know at all what was going on. Anyhow, I digress. But hopefully this is all useful. So here's another example of one of these little globular clusters, lots of older stars. And that is, the previous slide was NGC 6205. Again, just a telephone number, no particular meaning. But here is its colour magnitude diagram. And maybe what you can see, to give you a kind of visual impression, that for this one, the turnoff is quite high up the main sequence. Whereas this one, more Hubble telescope data, the turnoff is much lower down the main sequence. In fact, there's hardly any main sequence left. So the bottom line is, this cluster is much older than that one. Okay, that's basically how it goes. The details we don't need to get into, but that, you know, Hubble has allowed us to do this job more precisely than we could before. So that's just a little bit about star clusters, about how the Hubble telescope has contributed to our emerging understanding of how they evolve. We've also talked about what's actually going on inside the stars and the various cycles, CNO cycle and PP chain. What does all of that do to a star? So let's just flesh out a bit of the detail of that before the break. So let's first of all just take a star like the Sun again. So it's not hot enough for the CNO cycle. It's just got the proton-proton chain. So hydrogen can fuse in the core because the core is hot and dense enough to let that happen. Meanwhile, the outer parts of the star are cooler, and the very outer part of the Sun is basically kind of yellowy colour. It corresponds to a temperature of about 6,000 degrees. But when the fuel runs out for a star like the Sun, then, as I said a few minutes ago, to just recap that, the core will contract so that it gets even hotter, hot enough that all the helium that is now there in the core can start fusing into beryllium and heavier elements. So the core, about 20% of the star, has been turned completely from hydrogen into helium. Meanwhile, the rest of the outside is just still hydrogen. But if you want to get any more fusion happening in the middle, the only way it's going to happen is if the core contracts, and it does so. Helium starts to fuse into heavier elements. Meanwhile, the outer part of the star expands and cools. And if we're on the Earth then I'm afraid it's rather bad news. Because either the Sun will expand enough to swallow up the Earth, or it will still get big enough that it will be a lot hotter here on Earth than it is currently. So, artist's impression again, but we can certainly expect that this will be the fate that will befall Mercury and Venus, and very possibly the Earth as well.
Yes, I can understand why the central bit. There's no fusion going on.
Exactly, so there's no outward pressure, so gravity wins, it becomes hotter, fusion starts again.
Just can't quite understand why the outer bit gets pushed out.
It's really just a kind of pressure balance thing. It's essentially the inner structure of the star sort of adjusts itself so that you've got like a pressure gradient from the inner part to the outer. And essentially, the interior of a star is just fairly well described by the same kind of equations that would describe the gas in a room like this. So when you have a change in pressure, you'll also have a change in temperature. And that's essentially what happens. So the pressure outside drops. And the temperature will drop as well, it will expand. And it's really, there's a much simpler way to put it actually in a way, is to say that it's really just a conservation law at work, is that you're conserving the total amount of thermal energy in the star, and consequently it will expand to adjust. So inside such a red giant, what you've got is helium now burning in the core because it's hotter, and you'll have a shell of hydrogen burning around that, okay? Because, as I was saying there to Mark, you'll have a temperature gradient from the inside all the way out. I haven't bothered putting any numbers on, it's not really all that important, but the innermost temperature will now maybe be up in the 20 million degrees or more, and then the outer part is now 3,000 or so. So in between, you're going to have a narrow shell where it's hot enough for hydrogen to fuse, even if it's no longer hot enough for helium to fuse. You've got to go deeper into the core for that to happen. But that's not going to be a very extensive region. But nonetheless, it means that you'll have a little bit more helium then forming outside. Excuse me. So meanwhile, as the outer part is cooling, expanding to become the red giant, the core is still very hot. And that core eventually becomes what we call a white dwarf. So a white dwarf star is the core left behind when a red giant, a red supergiant, expands, and in fact the outer part of the star just actually drifts off. So if you wait long enough, what you'll be left with is the white dwarf star in the centre. Now Hubble has again made a big contribution here. This is a globular cluster, I think it's one we haven't seen before, I think it's M13, but they all kind of look the same. Ground-based image shows lots of stars all together, but they're too densely packed to make them out individually, whereas the Hubble telescope image shows little white smudges, conveniently shown with the white circles around. Those are just put on by the astronomers, I hasten to add. So those little white dots in the middle, those are white dwarfs. Again, it's consistent with the globular cluster being old, because these are what are left over after stars like the Sun have gone through their lifetime. So that might take, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 billion years to use up the hydrogen in the core, gets turned into helium, contracts, the helium can produce heavier elements all the way up to things like carbon, oxygen maybe. Meanwhile, the outer part is expanding, in fact just carries on. What you get is something called a planetary nebula, which is really beautiful. Some of them look amazing even through a small telescope. They look very, very impressive in Hubble images. This is what we think our Sun will eventually look like. The core of the Sun will be the white dwarf. If the artist's impression from a few slides ago is anything to go by, then the Earth will have been swallowed up long ago. But as that outer part cools and expands to maintain the overall temperature balance and energy balance, then it will just keep on expanding, and eventually the outer part of the star will just drift off into space. Again, you're just seeing a snapshot of it. You can't wait around to see it happen because it will take millions of years. But we see planetary nebulae at different stages of that process, and the picture that we build up is that this is what stars like the Sun will do. We have other guides, because we don't just get a snapshot of how the star looks, we can also measure how fast the gas is moving, because we can do that by looking at these spectral lines again that I've mentioned a number of times. The spectral lines will be shifted depending on whether the gas is coming towards us or moving away from us, and the amount of the shift tells you how fast the gas is moving. It's a little bit like what sound waves do. When a police car goes past, you hear the pitch of the sound waves change. So we can work out how long it would have taken this shell of material to basically get from there to there. And it's consistent with our understanding of the expansion rate of a red giant as it's undergoing these late stages of its evolution.
So most of the outer shell part of the red giant drifts off, doesn't contract back onto the white dwarf?
No. They're just, the gravity just isn't strong enough. For all these things are really massive, the amount of mass is dispersed over such a large area that the gravitational attraction is not really strong enough. Okay? By contrast, a white dwarf has got about the mass of the Sun, because it's the core of a star with maybe a mass of up to a few times that of the Sun, and yet its size is maybe about the same size as the Earth. So its gravity is very much higher, but out at the outer part of the star, the gravitational acceleration is not very high. Did somebody else have a question there, Tony?
So why, in the case of the supernova standard candle, does the white dwarf manage to pull off matter from its binary star?
Well,
but does it do that?
No, I mean you'll get a gradual sinking in. It's really just a question of scale. I mean, I'm not sure quite how big this thing is here. Certainly that is not the size of the white dwarf. For all its, a bright region in the middle, the white dwarf itself would be way smaller. But let's give you an example. If you take the artist's impression, you've got a red giant that's roughly the size of the Earth's orbit. That's 150 million kilometres in radius, whereas the Earth has got a radius of about 6,000 kilometres. So the core of the red giant is about 6,000, and the outer part of the red giant is 150 million. That's the difference. So basically the gravitational pull that the core can exert on the very outer part of the red giant is extremely weak, because it's too far away. In the case of the Type 1A supernovae, again, very good question, anticipates things we'll cover later, but let's just briefly discuss that. They're seen as good standard candles because that means that they've got more or less a steady luminosity from one object to another. Because what we believe they are is a white dwarf star that's got a binary companion. Now what you've got there is the binary companion very, very close to the white dwarf. So it's only pulling material from the bit of the companion star that's immediately adjacent to it. It doesn't really exert much of a gravitational pull on the other side of the binary companion. Again, I've got pictures that will illustrate that better in the weeks to come. But does that kind of basically answer it? Yeah, sure.
Can I add just in terms of our sun,
yeah,
from birth to death,
How long? Where are we? Middle-aged. So no need to panic. About 50%, yeah. So we've got, it's hard to be precise, but somewhere between about 4 and 5 billion years still to go.
And what would be the time scale from the Earth being habitable to being uninhabitable?
That is an excellent question. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer even the first bit of that, but, you know, no better an authority than David Attenborough that was watching the other night. You know, I suppose, I'm not trying to dodge the question, but it depends what you mean by habitable. We think there was life on Earth for a few billion years, but certainly the early Earth wouldn't have been suitable for us because there wasn't nearly enough oxygen in the atmosphere. So the build-up of oxygen to a point where, you know, well, reptiles, dinosaurs, those kind of animals would have been around, you know, that are sort of recognisable cousins of ones that we see today. You're talking somewhere between a few hundred million and a billion years. And really, unless we do something nasty to our own planet, which is entirely possible, of course, and as long as we avoid asteroid impact and all these other threats, then right up until, you know, a few hundred million years before the red giant phase begins, the Earth should continue to be perfectly habitable. So you're looking at sort of 7 or 8 billion years where, you know, things are fairly stable, the temperature's not changing too much, and you've got an atmosphere containing oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, that, I'm not saying we could breathe it all the time, but it's not so different from what we have now.
I thought the sun was getting hotter.
Yes, but not really at the sort of, well.
I read an article, and I'm not saying it's right, but it's increasing by about 10% every billion years.
Oh dear. Don't think it's as much as that.
Well, fair enough.
I'll check though. I'll check. I would have, if you'd asked me to pluck a figure out of the air, I would have said more like 1 or 2% every billion. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a million miles different from that, but it's not as big as, you know, doubling in temperature. As I said, let me go back to my main sequence diagram because I was being slightly economical with the truth, but not much. And it's a good question you ask and a good opportunity to expand that. We had our main sequence here, which shows the red curve, which I said, you know, all stars lie on. Well, as you can see, of course, the black dots don't all lie perfectly on it. There's a wee bit of spread. And we think that spread occurs over a star's lifetime. So there is a small change in its luminosity and possibly also a small change in its temperature over the lifetime. But even if it were to be 10% every billion years, okay, operation of compound interest, you know, it does build up.
It would be pretty hot after 2 billion.
Yeah. I think it's less than that, but I'll check that. It'd be kind of good to know what lies in store for us in a billion years. Right, so, yeah, we were talking about planetary nebulae. I've forgotten as to whether I answered your question properly. We were talking then about the lifespan. So yeah, we said about 7 or 8. So
a fair bit of time,
absolutely. It would have been quicker if I just said that. Of course, I was trying to be more quantitative. And then, as Tony says, there is. I certainly agree that there is good grounds for us to believe that the sun will hot up a little, but whether it would be sufficient to render the Earth uninhabitable, I don't believe that's the case. So I say I think the figure's less than the 10%, but I'll check. Just here's a few further examples of planetary nebulae. There's some more, really, among the most beautiful images we have from Hubble. And I say I've got a few names and numbers for you, so just to let you see those. Well, this one, of course, conveniently was written on it anyway. That's in the constellation of Aquila, the eagle. And, yeah. The nebula is a cloud of gas ejected several thousand years ago from the hot visible star in its centre. And these are shells of gas thrown out by sun-like stars nearing the end of their lives. So as I say, I've got some of those words on the wee notes pages. You can check out the details. This is an advanced camera image, the ACS camera that was put on board in 2002. And it's known as the Helix Nebula. And it's another example of a planetary nebula. A sun-like star that's reaching the end of its life. That'll be it way in there. Here's another one. And this is called the Ring Nebula. So it's a very famous one. What we think we're seeing here is a system that's about 2,000 light years away, which means that the overall structure is about a light year across. Now, a light year is a very great distance, about 10 million million kilometres. So that, again, gives us a kind of rather crude way to estimate how long this shell has been expanding for. Because we can measure its speed from spectral lines, alright, it's probably slowing down, but we can make some crude guesses as to how long it's taken to extend over that size. And, you know, the suggestion is that this has been expanding for many thousands of years. Here's a really pretty one, which is demonstrating that as these clouds of material expand, then they can kind of interact with surrounding gas. And this is called the Cat's Eye Nebula. It's quite structurally complex. It was discovered initially by William Herschel back in 1786, but, you know, ground-based images wouldn't look anything like as impressive as this. And actually the central star, we now realise, is a binary system, so that may have complicated the manner in which the shells of material were ejected, because it's a binary, so it's sort of rotating around its companion, therefore the material may not have expanded spherically in a circular shell, but instead in this sort of rather complicated pattern. Okay, so just to take us up to the break then, let's talk about what would happen to a very massive star where you don't get a planetary nebula and a white dwarf forming. Instead, what you get is something much more dramatic. You get a supernova explosion. This is technically what's known as a Type 2 supernova. The supernovae that we mentioned a few minutes ago in response to Tony's question are known as Type 1A supernovae, and we'll go into the details of those other sorts of supernovae in a subsequent week, because the Type 1As are especially relevant to cosmology. Type 2s are important for cosmology as well, but their main interest is actually to make chemicals, because all the iron in the universe wasn't made inside furnaces, wasn't, you know, the iron in your iron brew actually came not from girders, is the way I often put it, but from supernovae. Because the process that we kind of hinted at for a solar type star, where you could have helium forming in the core and maybe a bit of hydrogen burning around that, well, why stop there? When the helium's all been fused into heavier things like carbon, then, okay, you know, there won't be any outward pressure, so the star will collapse again. Maybe it will become even hotter. Therefore, eventually, maybe the carbon will start to fuse, and you'll get things like neon and magnesium. The oxygen could produce things like silicon and sulfur. Eventually, iron is kind of the end of the line, because the way the nuclear reactions work is that for elements heavier than iron, then you don't get any extra energy out. They're what's called endothermic. You've got to put energy in. And therefore, it's a kind of natural break-off point in the nuclear reactions that are happening inside the star. If you want to make anything heavier than iron, you need a kind of catalyst to make it happen. You need the very violent process of a supernova. So, to take a sort of cutaway picture of such a star, the colour scheme's different in this one, but still the same basic idea, that you've got this sort of onion skin type configuration where you've got stars made up of shells largely containing heavier and heavier elements, hydrogen on the outside, all the way down to iron in the middle. But when the iron can't fuse, so fusion switches off and the iron core contracts, well, okay, in principle it can get hotter because it's denser, but that doesn't help you to make heavier elements because the reactions don't work that way. So basically there's no source of any outward pressure to stop gravity from squeezing even more. So what you find is that instead of it being a balancing act between gravity and pressure, gravity just overwhelms the thing, and this little sequence of cartoon images is supposed to represent that. Then what happens is that eventually the core does stop the inward collapse, not because of nuclear fusion, but because of a different kind of outward pressure, which has got a very bizarre sounding name, called degeneracy pressure. And it's to do with the fact that eventually the matter in the core is packed in so tightly that the rules of physics, the rules of quantum physics, just don't allow you to make it any denser.
The same as the Fourier exclusion?
Basically, yeah. It's firmly connected to that. Indeed, one way that you can calculate roughly what density this will happen at is to also use the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So I don't really want to get into the details of that. You know, it's all fascinating stuff. Maybe, you know, can talk at the break about it. But essentially, the picture is that it's a bit like a rebound, that, you know, you've got this collapsing core which just keeps getting denser and denser, but eventually reaches a point where it can't collapse anymore, and then the material that's falling onto that, like, hits a brick wall, metaphorically, and rebounds off. And when it does, you know, which this sequence of little cartoon images is trying to represent, then the shell of material that rebounds off can rebound with a great deal of speed and energy, and can take the whole rest of the star with it. And we call that a supernova explosion.
Can I ask, what speed is that?
90% of the speed of light is not unheard of, you know, really, you know. Obviously, it slows down pretty fast, because as it expands, it slows down. But initially... Yes, absolutely. The more massive the star, you know, but basically the little thing in the middle, which we'll hear more about in a minute, but it's called a neutron star, the incredibly dense structure in the middle, which, you know, has reached the point where it just can't get any denser. How dense that is a limit kind of set by fundamental things, as Brendan says, it's to do with what's called the Pauli exclusion principle. Nature doesn't allow you to cram atoms in or subatomic particles in any more densely than a certain amount. But the material that's falling onto that, the more massive the star, you know, the more stuff there is to fall on, and then basically that will rebound, and the speed with which it rebounds is related to how fast it was falling in to begin with.
Right. So I think it was from the 11th century they met the supernova explosion.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. So over what period of time, in terms of the naked eye, would that explosion...
No, but it's near enough. I'm just going to come to that. It's an excellent question, because I've got a slide of that one supernova. So let me just show you this little sequence of images. You know, obviously that these are just little cartoon drawings, but this is, you know, imagining you being on a moon close to a blue supergiant star that's just about to go supernova. And the thing to say is that that's roughly in real time. Now, I know that's quite astonishing, but the collapse time is just a few seconds, and the rebound time is about the same. And, you know, that's you've got your explosion. So it's virtually like that, you know, and the thing is blown up. But what you're referring to is called the Crab Nebula, which is an object you can now see in the star. Now, the supernova that caused the Crab Nebula took place in the year 1054. Observed by Chinese astronomers, and it would have brightened over the course of just a few hours to be bright enough to be seen in the daytime sky. Okay, but remember, how bright a thing is isn't just about how much energy you have, but it's what volume you pack it into. Well, if you think of it this way, you know, you take one of these light bulbs, and it's got a certain intensity, a certain brightness, which obviously means if you're up real close to it, it looks pretty bright. But if you had the same intensity spread over the size of a lighthouse, then you'll see it from much further away. So the initial bounce and the initial shock wave that starts the supernova really does just take a few seconds. But if you're far away from it, hundreds or even thousands of light years away from it, then it's not going to be easily visible to the naked eye until it's a bit bigger than that, essentially, as the shock wave moves out and fills a bigger volume. So, and that process just kind of keeps on going because it keeps on expanding. So, you know, here's some examples of historical supernovae where you're now looking at the shell of material after it's expanded for maybe thousands of years, maybe 50,000 years in the case of this one. This is called the Veil Nebula. Here's one where it really did happen before our eyes. This is a before and after, one night apart, and that star there called the Tarantula Nebula went supernova in 1987, and that's it the next night. So, you know, it wasn't bright enough to be seen with the naked eye quite, although almost, but it's 150,000 light years away. If that had happened on our doorstep, we would have easily been able to see it. In fact, frankly, if it had happened too close to us, it would have been pretty bad news, because it would have been very damaging. I'll come back to this after the break, so let me just show you the crab. Yeah, there's the crab, which is the one that the Chinese astronomers observed in the year 1054. And the little neutron star that was the core left over when the very massive star collapsed and then rebounded, well, that neutron star is sort of deep inside here, probably about there, I think. It's fairly central, if I remember correctly. But this whole structure is, you know, about a light year across. And, I mean, you know, it happened of order 1,000. In fact, it might be even bigger than that. It's another number I need to check. I'm not so good at remembering these numbers exactly. But it happened of order 1,000 years ago. So the initial speed of the expansion was a good fraction of the speed of light. But, of course, it's been slowing down since. But it's still been able to grow to the size of at least a light year. I think it's roughly as about a light year across in that 1,000 years. Now, the person who discovered the little neutron star at the centre, very famous astronomer, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, this is her, as she was then, 1967, year I was born, and she was, at that stage, a graduate student working in Cambridge, and discovered radio signals coming from that neutron star, which is the reason why we actually call it a pulsar, because as the radio beam was sweeping past us, about 33 times a second, you would pick up a little radio pulse. And they were so regular that it was the case. I don't think Jocelyn thought this, but some people at the time wondered if it might be, you know, an artificial signal from an alien civilization. But it wasn't little green men. It was just something in a way even weirder. It was a tiny star with the mass of the sun only 10 kilometers across, spinning rapidly. So this pulsar with a very strong magnetic field, radio jets, deep in the heart, 10 light years, there you go, you see it was at least within a factor of 10, which is usually good enough for an astronomer. 10 kilometres across is the pulsar, and the nebula is about 10 light years across. So that pulsar could comfortably fit inside Glasgow, and yet it weighs the same as actually about two times the mass of the sun. So pulsars are weird, neutron stars are weird. Hubble's actually allowed us to image one, because they last for a long time. And after the nebula that, you know, surrounds the pulsar to begin with is dispersed over maybe a few hundred thousand years, then what you're going to be left with is just a little old pulsar on its own. And it might be moving through space quite fast. And here's an example of one, a neutron star that was imaged by Hubble 3 years apart, and it's moved a fair old way. You know, this is probably still only a tiny, tiny fraction of a degree in the sky, but it's enough that we can see that the neutron star is actually moving through space. Now, I skipped over a couple of things, so let me stop there, just to give my voice a wee bit of a rest, if nothing else. We'll backtrack after the break, so maybe we start again, well, it's 20 to 9, according to my watch, so if we start just before 9, if that's okay with folks, then we'll do another half hour, and I'll finish the story of stars, and it looks like we'll be able to just begin a few things about planets as well. Okay, so thank you. See you in about 20 minutes. Let me just start the recording again. With Hubble, we're able to look at objects like supernovae or planetary nebula and look at them in sufficient detail that sometimes we can see changes over time. We've been talking through the rest of the course about timescales that are often billions of years. And I've been saying, well, you know, we have to try and make sense of stars and how they evolve by a series of snapshots. That's broadly true. But every now and again, you can take advantage of something happening on a fairly short time scale, like a few decades, or even a few years, and therefore you can maybe see small changes even in such a short time scale like that. And here's a good example. So this is an example of what we call a light echo. And what I want you to get from this is that here we are on the Earth and we're looking at light coming from some star. And of course the light might just come straight towards us, but light might also reflect off material around the star. And if it does, well, it could maybe reflect from different places. The crucial point is it means that the light will then arrive at different times. And you'll see a kind of sequence of echoes, you know, just like you would with sound waves. If you hear the reflected sound arriving at a different time, you'll hear your voice again and again. So what we see here is a picture of a dust shell around a supergiant star. This one is in the constellation of Monocerotis. I think that's the, I've said that wrong. I always get my constellation names wrong. It's the unicorn Monoceros, and the star is called V838 Monocerotis, meaning V838 in the constellation of Monoceros. It's about 20,000 light years away. And the circular feature that you see here has expanded a lot even over the course of the last 8 or 9 years. So I think I can show that. Now wait a minute, I think I've got this as an animated GIF. That's it, yeah. Thought it was simpler rather than me flicking back and forth. So it's the same star, and these are multiple images of it taken with Hubble over a period of about 7 or 8 years. So first of all, the shell of material really is expanding. But what you've got to fold in with that is the kind of optical illusion effect that if you're seeing light reflecting off different parts of the shell, then the light might arrive at different times. And therefore you've got to take account of that when you're trying to make sense of the structure. And in fact, according to the people who've been working on this, reading their article, it's anticipated that actually within a year or two, it will start to appear as if it's contracting. And it's because what we'll be seeing is light coming from a time when the shell was smaller. But the light's taking longer to get to us. Okay? So at first glance, it will look, hey, that's crazy, what's going on? The shell isn't contracting, surely. But it's because we're seeing the light catching up that actually set off longer ago. So there's all these wonderful subtle effects that Hubble has helped us to unlock, because as is so often the case, the key thing that it gives us is extremely good resolution in the images. We can see features that are very small, and also we get very sharp images, so we can measure the sizes of things very precisely. And it really then just becomes a kind of high school geometry problem, not the one I would wish to tackle, but perfectly doable. You're trying to work out, you know, how far away is it, and where is the material where the echoes are occurring around it. So this has opened, you know, fresh avenues of study. And in a way, it's a little bit like, you know, being a dentist. I've heard this analogy used by some colleagues. I would never have thought of it myself. But essentially what you can do is you can use the reflected light that's coming in the echo to reveal something about what's going on in the heart of the shell. In the same way as dentists must be very astute at this. I don't know if we've got any dentists in the room. But, you know, I've always thought that when you consider that all they're seeing is just that little bit of mirror, and yet they can still somehow work out what's going on as they poke around at your teeth. In the same way, the sort of dentist mirror that these light echoes offer provides a way to work out something more detailed about what's going on at the star in the centre. So that's one of the most exciting and really cutting edge examples, and definitely one to watch this space for, because now that we know that Hubble's going to be operating for a bit longer, then we can continue to monitor this star for the next few years and see some of these optical illusion effects for ourselves. Okay? So this is just a still image of the same system. And it emphasizes that over the course of the last 7 years since the advanced camera system was installed, then this supergiant star, the shell of material around it, has changed appreciably. So more supernovae fragments, these are the things that we were looking at just before the break. Some really beautiful ones. Let me make sure I get the name of this one right. This is a supernova remnant within the Large Magellanic Cloud. The supernova that produced this would have happened thousands of years ago, long before recorded history. But the one that we talked about before the break, that was observed by the Chinese astronomers, can be dated very precisely. We know it was 1054, the year 1054. Here's another one. This is known as Cassiopeia A, and this is an explosion which is the youngest known remnant from a supernova in the Milky Way. This is within the last 500 years. I forget the precise date, and I don't think there's any record of us observing it, but we can work out roughly when we think it did happen, again by running the clock back from where the shell of material currently is. And there's the crab that we talked about before, the radio pulsar at the heart of which is the object that Jocelyn Bell discovered.
These are all type 2s, aren't they?
These are all type 2s, yeah. Although I told her a few years ago, I met her at a conference and this made her laugh. I said that some years ago we'd had a quiz for our first year astronomy class and I'd shown them the photo. I said, what did this famous astronomer discovered in 1967, and somebody put the answer contact lenses, which I thought was very unfair, but Jocelyn had a good laugh at that. It's quite striking for me to think that, you know, even for many of our students now, 1967 is just, you know, unimaginably long ago. You know, the fact that they found out that I was born that year, you know, only confirms in their mind that I'm a, you know, an old has-been. But the fact that, you know, someone like Jocelyn, a really important figure, made a discovery like that more than 40 years ago, I try my best to link them to the past, but in some ways they almost seem to find it easier to relate to the likes of Galileo or Newton than to, you know, people that were alive in the 60s. You know, that's when their mums and dads were alive. You know, it's maybe something to do with that. But anyway, she's been a beacon of, just what can be achieved to many a generation of students since the 60s. So, that's kind of almost wraps it up for stars, and kind of sets the scene for us to discuss planets. So let me just make the final few remarks about stars by just emphasising again the range of scales, and this is a series of images that were put together by a science museum in the US, and I think just helps us to see the range of scales in question. So we've got the Earth there, we've got Jupiter, we've got the Sun, but to emphasise that among the stars we've been looking at are both the very small and the very large. So let's see that at work. Jupiter would be about 1 pixel in that scale, the Earth totally invisible already. Sirius is a bit bigger than the Sun and appears the brightest star in the sky after the Sun, largely because it's not very far away. It's about 8 light years away. Pollux of Castor and Pollux is more massive still. Arcturus is very much more massive than the Sun and more luminous. But even that's peanuts compared with the next slide. There's Arcturus there. You've got a blue supergiant like Rigel, where the Sun would only be 1 pixel in size. You've got Aldebaran in the constellation of Taurus. You've got Antares in the constellation of Scorpius, and Betelgeuse in the constellation of Orion, all of which are red supergiants, and totally swallow up the Sun. So just, you know, the Earth would be microscopic at this scale. Or to put it all another way, to bring us back to Hubble, Betelgeuse is so big that it's the one star that we've been able to use Hubble to actually resolve as more than just a point of light. So this is a Hubble image of the surface of Betelgeuse. Now it was taken with an ultraviolet filter. So actually, technically, it's not really the surface. It's a region just a bit below that, a bit deeper into Betelgeuse, where the temperature is hotter, and therefore the light is giving off mainly radiation in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. Because remember, Betelgeuse is cool on the surface, so it's red in colour, so it gives off most of its light in the infrared from the surface. But the figures are nonetheless impressive. That would be the size of the Earth's orbit. So Betelgeuse wouldn't just swallow up the Earth, it would even swallow up Jupiter if it was in our solar system. And despite being several hundred light years away, Hubble can show Betelgeuse as more than just a point of light, but actually as a disk. And notice that you see a variation in colour, which reflects a variation in temperature. So what we think we're seeing here is evidence that a bit like a pan of boiling water, that there are cells of gas which are kind of bubbling up from deep down inside Betelgeuse's atmosphere. Some of them are hotter, therefore, you know, it's not a very detailed map because we're seeing things very much at the limit of Hubble's resolution, but there's a big cell across a good chunk of Betelgeuse's diameter which is hotter. And this is consistent with the belief that Betelgeuse is actually a variable star. It's changing in brightness. And it's very likely that back in Greek times, Betelgeuse was actually brighter than Rigel, which is why Betelgeuse is referred to as Alpha Orionis, the brightest star in Orion. These days, its typical brightness is a bit less than Rigel. Not much, they're almost as bright as each other. As you know, you can see Orion on a clear night. They both stand out. But the variability of Betelgeuse is perhaps one indication that it might not be too long before it goes supernova. But we don't really expect it in our lifetime. You know, it could be 1,000 years, could be 1,000,000 years, but sooner or later, Betelgeuse is going to go the way of some of those other supernovae that we've seen before. Okay, so that's all about how stars die. And I'd just like to kick off a little bit about planets. And I'd like to begin by a little word about Giordano Bruno, a very prophetic soul from the 16th century, who speculated that all those stars we saw in the sky, those bright lights we saw in the sky, were perhaps just like our own sun, and that perhaps they contained animals and maybe even people, just like our own Earth. So it's clear that we've been searching for other planets out there in space for thousands of years, hundreds of years at least, perhaps even thousands, in the sense that, you know, for all we know, primitive peoples may have speculated, you know, looked up at the lights in the sky, wondered what they were. We certainly know something of the myths and legends that they passed on to us. But what's fundamentally different about these last few years is that for the first time ever, we have at least the possibility that we might be able to find such planets and maybe even find life like us. We might find nothing, but it's worth looking. And that's really where one of the most active and exciting fields of astronomy has come about. It's the quest for planets around other stars, and possibly even planets like the Earth around other stars. And Hubble's played its role there too. So I'd like to just start a discussion of that, and that will spill over into next week. So just before we get going on that, let me remind you a little of what we talked about before, how stars form. We talk about this balance between pressure and gravity, that a gas cloud will collapse under its own gravity, but as it does, it heats up, and eventually the pressure from the hot gas becomes sufficient to support it. But what I don't think I mentioned before is that the gas cloud will almost certainly be spinning as well. And I think this relates a bit to what I think Brendan and Margaret were talking about earlier, that we're looking here at a single cloud. But what's more reasonable to think of is that this would be a fragment of something much bigger. Because that ultimately, as we'll see in a few weeks' time, the process that we're describing here is quite similar to how a galaxy itself forms. A collapsing gas cloud, sort of a fragment breaking away from other gas clouds. So, as those fragments break apart, it's very likely that they'll have some rotational motion. They won't just break apart and be static. And as they rotate, that will, in a rather similar way to how if an ice skater pulls their arms in, they spin faster, the rotation will actually increase as the cloud collapses. And as this rotating gas cloud or nebula collapses, it will likely flatten as well. This is to do with what we call the conservation of angular momentum. And you'll likely wind up with a bulge in the middle, which will become the star, but in the disk around it, which isn't going to be completely uniform, and if you want a good analogy for this, you know, just try making a cake in a mixing bowl, and you'll see the same kind of phenomena happen. You'll get little lumps forming, and for a few seconds they'll be there, and then they might lose their coherence. But of course this process is happening much more slowly. The rotation isn't quite as fast as a mixing bowl, and therefore these lumps might actually become big enough to break away and become planets, protoplanets if you like. They're still in the process of forming. You've got your protosun in the middle, protoplanets forming in the disk. Now this isn't just all wild speculation, because we can basically look for signs of this with telescopes. And the Orion Nebula that we talked about before, which is a place where new stars are being formed, looked at through the Hubble telescope, reveals these, which are little disks around a newly forming star where it is believed there may well be little planets in the process of forming, called protoplanetary disks, or proplids for short. There's a close-up. This is quite an old image. It's one of the most striking ones that was obtained even in the early days before the shortly after the refurbishment, when they corrected the optics, but before the advanced camera or any of the more sophisticated instruments were installed. So ever since, we've been finding planets orbiting other stars. This is a very recent image, just taken from the website of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. And this number may well even have changed since last Wednesday when I downloaded this. The number of planets we're finding is going up all the time, but last Wednesday at least it was 336. 336 planets, but 285 stars with planets. So that tells you that we're now also finding a lot of stars that have got multiple planets, just like our own sun. We'll say more about that next week. Earth-like planets, zero. Still haven't found any of those yet. But that number could change, because on March the 5th of this year, a new space probe called Kepler is going to be launched. And I know this is supposed to be a course about the Hubble telescope, but if before the course ends Kepler finds an Earth-like planet, I'm sure you'll forgive me if I devote a bit of attention away from Hubble and talk about that instead. Absolutely, I'll talk about that next week. Again, I want to be as up to date as possible. It's 2 point something, 2 and a bit times, but it's getting pretty close. There are two basic criteria for an Earth-like planet. First of all, it's got to be about the same size as the Earth, but you also want it to be in roughly the same place as the Earth, and i.e. quite close to its star. And we have found some pretty small planets using a technique that I wasn't really going to say a great deal about. It's called microlensing. But we will talk a bit about gravitational lensing in a subsequent week in relation to the Hubble telescope. Gravitational lensing is all to do with the bending of light by the presence of matter. And gravitational microlensing is a way to find really quite small planets. But the best place you're going to find them will be far away from their parent star, where it would be much too cold for life like us. Now, what's the big hang-up with life like us? It's a good point. there could be life out there and we wouldn't even know it's life because we wouldn't know what we're looking for. But by and large, the way that the search has gone so far, and to be quite cynical, it's really because, you know, it's easy to get funding for doing this sort of thing, is to look for life like us, to look for signs of oxygen, carbon dioxide, and water. You know, going along to a funding agency and saying, give us billions of dollars to build a telescope to look for some other kind of life. We don't know what we're looking for, but we'll just cross our fingers. That's never going to work. So what you do is you go along and say, we're going to look for these biomarkers. We're going to look for these signatures of life like us. And that's how it's been done.
In terms of the figure of 285 stars with planets,
yep.
And many have been examined, is that 1% or
0.5%? Oh, good grief, not anywhere like 1%. We think there's about 100,000 million stars in our own galaxy. So we're only, it's a drop in the ocean. But, you know, your question's a good one, because the 285 is still a substantial fraction of all the stars that we could actually hope to find a planet, because most of that 100,000 million, they're all too far away, we'd never be able to see the planets. We'll go into more of that at the start of next week. So actually, you know, we've by no means exhausted our local neighbourhood, but we're well on our way to cataloguing planets around all the plausible candidates in our local neighbourhood, including several of the stars that feature in Star Trek, for example. We have actually found a planet around the star that Mr. Spock's supposed to be from. Rather disappointingly, it's not been called Vulcan, but you know, that's an example of where, you know, truth can be stranger than fiction. Okay, so what have we learned? Let me just spend the last couple of minutes just summarising where things are. So that's the situation last week, 336 planets. In 2000, we'd found 29, and at the beginning of next week, I'll explain a wee bit about what these funny-looking graphs mean. And then by 2005, we'd found 136. So the number's going up all the time. And what I want to cover next week is to talk about how we've found all these planets, what they're like, and how the Hubble telescope has helped. But essentially, if you can't wait that long and you want to have a wee look for yourself, then this is a good website, www.exoplanets.org. It's got some good background information. And the bottom line, as we'll see in more detail next week, is that nowadays what we're getting better at doing is finding less massive planets further away from their parent star. Now, I said a few minutes ago that you want to get these planets quite close to their parent star if you want them to be like the Earth. You don't want them to be too far away. Actually, most of the planets we found in the first few years were too close to the star. They were so close that they were extremely hot, commonly referred to as hot Jupiters, very massive, much more massive than the Earth, and way too close to be suitable for liquid water, for example. And we'll see the reason for that next week. Okay? So, I think that's probably a good point at which to stop. What I'm going to begin with next week is telling you all the reasons why you can't find extrasolar planets from the ground, and then we'll see the methods that do work and why the Hubble telescope has helped. Okay? So, thanks for all the excellent questions, and we'll see you all next week. And what I will also do next week is I'll bring along some details of how, if you wish to, you can write a short essay on the themes of the course in order to get some ACE credits. It's entirely optional, but I know that some people in the past have enjoyed doing that. So, more details on that next Monday. Thanks. Absolutely. Absolutely. All the stars we've talked about have either been within our galaxy or just immediately adjacent to our galaxy.
Up there under the influence of the galaxy.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And everything that will follow in the remaining, well, we've got a bit more to cover in planets, but once we've done that, then everything else we'll talk about for the remaining 4 weeks will be about outside of our galaxy. And, okay?